KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
40s.
We're very unforgiving of sexual personal life of these officials, yet we're incredibly permissive when it comes to promiscuous failure, to incompetence.
It's like people didn't like me, just instantly would not like me. And, you know, society is kind of trained to, well, if you're not within these parameters, you're an outsider.
I am telling you, the claim that President Obama weakened welfare reform's work requirement is just not true.
Welcome to Weekday for a Tuesday. You heard Thomas Ricks talking about the affair General Petraeus is accused of having, or has admitted having. And following on Ricks' book, The Generals, we'll talk about competence and incompetence in the Army. Also, we're going to have a long report on autism and living with autism. Ryan Buckaloo has produced a series of reports. We're going to listen to those and then get your reaction. How have you lived with autism? How have you lived with a child with autism or your own? But we start with a look at welfare reform. You heard President Clinton there saying that, I'm telling you, the claim that President Obama weakened the work requirements on welfare reform are not true. During the campaign, President Obama listed social welfare programs as one of the accomplishments of his administration. His opposition claimed he had created a culture of dependency by gutting the work requirement and not working on welfare reform. Now that he has been reelected, what chances are there to use the social service programs in place to help people out of poverty? Robert Plotnick is a professor of public affairs and associate dean of the Evans School at the University of Washington. He's been studying social welfare policy, doing economic analysis on them for many years. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So we were just kicking this notion around. That's why we called you up,
because
you know these things. And just on that one question, looking into it, whether work requirements have been reduced for the Clinton era welfare reform program, that, you know, workfare instead of welfare. What the president has said is they gave the states the flexibility that the states had asked for in terms of applying welfare and work requirements. Is that how you look at it? How do you see what's happened in the past couple of years?
Yeah, ever really since the mid-90s, states have had a huge amount of flexibility in defining and managing their welfare programs. So that continues a almost 20-year trend now.
Do the states have remarkably different approaches to helping people out of poverty through social programs?
They do. It's, you know, every state's somewhat different. Some states provide higher cash benefits than others, and maybe two or three times as much. California, for example, would be among the leaders. We're not bad, and the southern states tend to be pretty stingy in terms of benefits. But there are also quite a range of differences in terms of work programs that they'll offer and so-called sanctions, what kind of penalty states will levy if a person on TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, isn't complying with regulations. So this was really a signature of the 96 reform, opening up the welfare system to enormous state flexibility.
So in taking a look at this again and thinking about the charge of the culture of dependency, I was looking at some of the other articles that people have written, some of the work coming from the Cato Institute, for example, and other places. When you hear that phrase, the culture of dependency, does it mean something to you?
What it means to me is that they're implying there are folks who get used to government benefits, and as a consequence of knowing they can fall back on them, they take less effort to earn their way out of poverty. They are more irresponsible with their kids or with their family arrangements. So that's the culture of dependency is kind of the shorthand code for that kind of charge against people depending on welfare benefits. It's usually not charged against, of course, people on Social Security or unemployment benefits. But if it's income tested, that's the rap.
Or corporate tax loopholes or the other things. But what's the evidence that there is that we have created in this country among an underclass? I put that in quotes.
Right.
A culture of dependency.
I think it's pretty slim myself. You'll get disagreement on this. There's reasonable evidence that income support does reduce work effort to some extent, but it's a modest amount in my judgment. And I guess so that's one where there's much less evidence of any dependency is on the sort of family behavior. There's the typical charges of welfare encouraging unwed childbearing and cohabitation and perhaps encouraging people to divorce and so forth. And so there's been an enormous amount of research on the so-called demographic consequences of income support. And by and large, I mean, the research consensus is these effects are extremely small, if any. So it's kind of a story that has some resonance. You can tell a story why there might be incentives, but that's not good enough. You got to see if the incentives are big enough to matter, and they just don't seem to be significant in any meaningful way.
Well, I was looking at a paper you wrote a few years ago, and you had a chart in here, poverty among persons using alternative measures. So you had different measures of looking at poverty in America. And from 1965 to 2008, in most of those measures, though not in the official measure, but only a slight difference, the percentage of poor people in the country hasn't really changed very much.
Right.
Why is that? Given the expansion of the social service programs.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story, but I'll try to keep it short.
You know how we operate now.
One of those trends shows that if you just look at people's private incomes, earnings and dividends and interest, those sorts of things, there's been very little change in poverty since the mid-60s. And that's a combination of really, I think, two major things. First of all, that measure includes the elderly, so we don't expect the elderly to earn their way out of poverty. And so that's one reason why it's not going down. Indeed, as the share of the population that's over 65 has gone up, that's pushing this measure up, if you will. When you look at more working-age folks, you've got several factors that have made it very harder and harder for low-wage folks to earn their way out of poverty. It's now, after the campaign and for the past few years, people have talked ever more about, you know, the 1%, the 99%, about growing income inequality. Growing income inequality means those at the bottom are actually earning less now than they did for the same amount of work, same work time, than they did, say, 15 or 20, 25 years ago. So these long-term labor market forces that are really making it very hard on low-skill or medium-skill workers has just kept their earnings extremely low. And even if they've worked, say, even if the work's gone up, wages haven't gone up, and so the poverty rate has been pretty stagnant.
Now, you've looked at the critique that says, well, it's because you are also paying a minimum wage that's too high, and therefore companies don't hire as many low-income workers because they can't afford it. And now with the welfare reform coming up, the healthcare reform coming up, it'll even be more so.
Yeah, the minimum wage story, first of all, this applies to folks who are earning above the minimum wage but hardly sort of a great wage. You know, if you're making $12 or $13 an hour, you're well above the minimum. But for folks like that, on average, their earnings have still been stagnant. So maybe they're making $15,000, $18,000 bucks a year, but it's not because of the minimum is discouraging employers. It's just that medium and low wages have been stagnant for many years. On the minimum wage question itself, there is evidence that employers cut back on hiring. It's mostly teenagers, and it's remarkably few adults that lose their jobs or don't get jobs because of the because of the minimum wage. So it's a very, very small factor is what it comes down to. What's surprising to many people, including me when I first read it, is that most minimum wage workers aren't poor. They're the teenagers working after school, but their parents are making a decent income. They're the second earners in the family working at a low-wage job, but the first earner is making enough that the family's not poor. So the minimum wage has actually very, very little impact on poverty simply because most minimum wage workers aren't living in poor families.
Robert Plotnick is a professor of public affairs and associate dean of the Evans School at the University of Washington. He's been studying poverty and poverty programs. So part of the reason why this is coming up is because the fiscal cliff
Yes.
will mean that some people will want to take a look at these large social welfare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, but not just those, and say, we need to cut these, and hence the argument of the culture of dependency. Look, we're just creating people who don't want to work, and we've got to get rid of those disincentives. So they're going to look at those programs, and they're going to look for places to cut them. What would be the worst, from your assessment, places to cut? And well, let me start with that.
Okay. In terms of the greatest damage to low-income families, especially low-income families with children, and in many ways the poverty discussion is about people with kids. We're much less concerned about, you know, the single guy who's 22 and not working, or a couple that's doesn't have children. I think the two most damaging cuts would be SNAP, that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, what we used to call food stamps, which is much more important now than cash assistance, say, compared to 20, 25 years ago. It's a critical part of the safety net, and it's the most widely available part of the safety net. Cutting that would have immediate adverse consequences on literally millions of low-income families. That would be my first thing I'd want to preserve. The second would be TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. That's the cash assistance program, what we used to call – what we still call welfare. Those who are old enough to remember will remember AFDC, the Aid to Families with Dependent Children, which was the predecessor of TANF. These payments go to extremely low-income families with children, and those benefits are already extremely meager. They've been declining for many years. To cut them yet again will just continue a trend that's extremely damaging to low-wage, to low-income families with kids.
This is where states have flexibility.
Yes. The nice thing about SNAP is that it's a federal program, so states have some flexibility, but the benefit levels are pretty much set by the feds.
By the way, the rap on President Obama was he'd expanded SNAP. Can you correlate the expansion of food stamps with the recession? Is that why it expanded?
That's why it's programs like this are supposed to expand when there's a recession. They are the safety net, and that's the whole point of a safety net. When times are tough, it provides a floor for people to who have to fall back on it. So this is a success, not a failure.
So if those would be the problematic cuts that they might look at, what would be programs that you would see changed or money you would see reduced that would be effective?
That's a great question, and you know, I'm not a big fan of cutting social programs by own politics, but if I were really had to come up with some cuts, the big money here is in Social Security and Medicare, not in these cash and income tested programs like food stamps and TANF or the Earned Income Tax Credit. They're big, but they're not nearly as big as Social Security and Medicare. So where I'd be looking, frankly, on the Social Security side, I think a very easy cut to justify, though hard politically, is to change the indexing formula for Social Security. It goes up with the rate of inflation, but there's very good evidence now from a consensus of economists that the inflation measure we use overstates inflation. So in some sense, folks are getting more than compensated. So if you trim that measure, that adds up. You know, if it's 0.5%, 1% a year difference over a few years, that adds up to literally billions of dollars of savings in Social Security. And I think it actually would have no – it would fulfill the intent of the program, which is to maintain the purchasing power of Social Security.
Would you put means testing to Medicare?
No, I don't think means testing is a good idea, because there's an old saying that says programs for the poor become poor programs. When you start to income test programs, you get the charge that they're creating dependency. You get the charge that these are for people who aren't like you. These are people who aren't responsible. Medicare's available to everybody who's paid into the Medicare system. It's what we might call social insurance or universal program. I think politically it's important to maintain that. If we're going to cut Medicare expenses, that's a tough one. You know, we talk about ways of controlling. Probably the best hope is to control the increase in health care costs rather than to cut the benefits per se. If you control the increase in health care costs, and there's some hope that Obamacare would help in that respect, then that will cut the spending rate without cutting benefits per se.
All right. We just sort of touched on this as a floor, by which we'll look at these discussions that they're going to have over the next few months. I hope we can, or a few weeks, I should say. I hope we can touch back with you, see what you think.
Sure, be happy to.
Robert Plotnick is Professor of Public Affairs, Associate Dean of the Evans School at the University of Washington. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Good morning, it's 9:20. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. When you think of people who use Medicare, senior citizens might come to mind, and they do account for over 80% of the 49 million Americans on Medicare. But Medicare also has millions of indirect, unexpected beneficiaries. We'll find out who this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics, offering graduate business degrees for working professionals. Next information sessions are Wednesday, November 14th in Bellevue and Saturday, November 17th in Seattle. More at seattleu.edu/albers.
We have cloudy skies in Seattle, 51 degrees right now in the University District. Working towards a high of 52, forecast calls for clouds and showers the rest of today. Same for tonight, clouds and showers, the low in the low 40s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow with a chance of showers, the high in the low 50s.
Now a special report from Brian Buckaloo on young people living with autism. And we hope you'll listen and then share your thoughts and experiences with us as a person living with autism, as somebody who's lived with people with autism. We'll get some of your thoughts and reactions to this long piece at about 9:45. We'll take your calls, 206-543-5869. You can also write us, weekday at kuow.org, get some of your responses to this story. Health experts in the United States estimate 1 in 88 children has some type of autism spectrum disorder. In Washington State, the number of public school children with a diagnosis on the autism spectrum has increased by 430% in the last decade. And in the next decade, teens who have been on that spectrum and receive that diagnosis, they become adults. So this morning we introduce you to some of those young adults coming of age with autism, reported by KUOW's Brian Buckaloo.
Growing up, Jordan Howard always felt like an outsider. He had trouble making friends. He felt awkward in groups.
Yeah, there was always that kind of, you know, after school movie cliche of, you know, no one understands me. I'm different than everybody else.
But it never felt like a cliche to Jordan. He really did feel different than everybody else, and he could never put his finger on why.
I always felt like there's something I'm doing subconsciously, like something I'm saying, and I don't think that it's a problem or anything. And I'm doing it, and people are going, whoa, that's weird, but I'm not picking up on it or something.
Other kids would bully him. Even his own brother and sister would pick on him.
It's like people didn't like me, just instantly would not like me. And, you know, society is kind of trained to, well, if you're not within these parameters, you're an outsider. It's really kind of sad, you know. But I've really just kind of learned to be alone.
Jordan turned 22 this October. He lives at home in Federal Way. Until this year, he spent most of his time alone. But then he learned something that totally changed his perspective.
At first, it was like a kind of a door is open, kind of an enlightenment.
Jordan had been suffering from depression, and one day his regular doctor sent him to a therapist. That therapist diagnosed Jordan with Asperger's syndrome.
I was just like, okay, well, that explains why this happened to me when I was younger, or why I did this, or why I do this, and it was kind of explaining all my little quirks.
Like his fixation with British rock bands, or why he's bad at giving compliments. Asperger's syndrome is a milder form of autism. Autism is a range of disorders that affect social and communication skills. Symptoms range from mild to severe. That's why it's called a spectrum disorder. Jordan's discovery was a revelation. After all those years assuming he was different than his peers, to have it actually confirmed?
At first, it was kind of a relief. it was like this huge sense of relief that, okay, it's not that I'm strange, it's there is actually something wrong.
Jordan's psychologist suggested he join an autism support group. He was skeptical at first. He'd never fit into a group before in his life. But he decided to give it a shot. On the first day, he showed up wearing a t-shirt with the logo of a British rock band, Joy Division. He walked in the door, and a guy named Dorian said, "You like Joy Division? Then you must know New Order." And Jordan said, "Well, you probably know the Smiths."
And it was just like, instantly right there, just became friends. It was like almost instant friendship thing. And I've never, ever had that before.
Jordan had finally found a group of friends he could identify with. Over the course of the summer, Jordan and Dorian became closer friends as they helped manage a tent together at the Federal Way Farmers Market.
So what we're doing is we're having a nonverbal person come to work with us today.
That's Dorian Hinkle, Jordan's friend. He has Asperger's syndrome too. The nonverbal person who's coming is named Rolando. He's 19 years old.
We're just going to try and work with him like he's an adult, treat him like he is an adult.
Why do that?
Well, because it helps to raise self-esteem and it gives, well, and it's just the decent thing to do. You treat someone like they're an adult.
Have you ever done this before? Have you ever worked with someone?
No, this is my first time. This will be exciting. This is a trial by fire.
Another guy is not so excited.
For me, it can be a little frustrating, but I'm able to keep my patience pretty much in check.
That's Alex Brenner, another guy in Jordan's new group of friends. Alex also has Asperger's syndrome. I ask him why it's frustrating to work with nonverbal people like Rolando.
I guess because I'm not really, I can communicate with my voice, and it's really hard for me to put myself in their shoes, which is ironic since I do have a disability myself.
But the range of severity between autism spectrum disorders is huge. For example, Alex hopes to get accepted to the University of Washington. The hope for Rolando is to get him out of the house and into the community. As I talk to Alex and Dorian, they study note cards. On the top is printed, "Working with a nonverbal person." Below is a list of 10 bullet points. The last one is in bold. Keep in line of sight constantly and redirect if he tries to run. Alex is nervous about how customers might react.
They're going to probably like raise their eyebrows or maybe be discouraged, but for those who are at least open-minded enough, which I hope most of them are, I just hope they see him as more of a person than kind of more as like kind of a distraction or just somebody who can't do anything.
Alex isn't the only one with questions about how people with autism spectrum disorders will be viewed by the public. Experts say the number of young adults leaving the school system will likely become a wave in the next decade. And no one's quite sure how much they'll be able to participate in public life. It's also hard to tell whether they'll be accepted and supported by other people with autism. Rolando's first visit to the farmer's market goes well, but when he visits a second time, Alex is mean to him. Alex gets frustrated and orders Rolando around, talking down to him like a misbehaved child. Alex is uncomfortable talking about it later.
I've always worked around people who were disabled that could talk, and to not have somebody respond to you is really awkward. And so, unfortunately, I think I just ignored him and just, God, I'm ashamed.
Alex apologized. He also dug out some old toys he used to play with, and he gave them to Rolando.
He likes those fuzzy things, so.
How did he react?
I think he was happy. I mean, that's one of the things about nonverbal people. It's they express themselves differently, and they should have realized that.
For Alex, it was a lesson in acceptance. He says he should have realized he was treating Rolando unfairly.
And kind of, you know, don't assume just because they are always, that they can't communicate or can't talk to you, doesn't mean that they're stupid.
Was that a familiar, I mean, would that be a familiar feeling to you, having somebody maybe not understand you?
A little, but I don't think I was, I didn't really see the bigger picture back then, like I do now.
Acceptance. It's the same thing Alex wants as he hopes to get into college.
That's Brian Buckaloo. He's reporting on coming of age with autism, introducing us to Jordan Howard. We're going to find out what happens with Alex and college in about 7 minutes. We're going to want your responses, your thoughts, your experiences dealing with autism as well. For some young adults with autism, the path to independence is the job. A recent study says 1 in 3 young adults with autism has no paid job experience, no college, and no technical school, nearly 7 years after high school graduation. The first job is a hurdle for anyone who struggles with social skills. That struggle can be part of living with autism. Dr. April Walter is trying to address that with a group of young adults in Federal Way. And this summer, she set up a tent there at the farmer's market, and she put them to work. Brian Bucklew takes us there.
The first time Rolando Elias came to the market, Dr. April Walter was nervous.
That was a big-time risk. It could have blown up in my face.
Rolando is 19 years old. His autism symptoms are considered severe. He doesn't speak. He'll run if he gets nervous. The Federal Way Farmers Market is bordered on two sides by roads with heavy traffic. And that, of course, raises the question, why take the risk?
Because it's important. Everybody needs a purpose in life. And especially with the nonverbal kids, they often will never have a purpose. Autism is often individual. I mean, people feel isolated. The families feel isolated.
Dr. Walter's goal in setting up a vendor's tent at the farmer's market was to take away some of that isolation. Antonio Elias knows that feeling well. He's Rolando's father. When Rolando was diagnosed, Antonio had no idea what to do.
I remember it was a children's hospital driving back home over the bridge on I-5. I was shaking, thinking, you know, my only son has autism.
He says he wanted to jump off the bridge running over Lake Union. Of course, he didn't. Instead, he calmed himself that day by resolving to do whatever he could to help his son. Now, over a decade later, Rolando is almost finished with high school. He's enrolled in an employment transition center in Federal Way. And as Antonio watches Rolando at the market and thinks back to that very first day, he's surprised at how far they've come.
Oh, it makes me feel real proud. You know, I never expect him to be like this right now, like he is right now, be part of a group, be part of a community. I never expect him to be like this. So I feel really, really proud.
Still, the farmer's market adds up to 3 hours, one afternoon a week during the summer. Finding ways to fill the time is the tallest hurdle for families that have children with autism leaving school. Rolando's parents don't know if he'll ever be able to live by himself. They do know that one day he'll probably have to live without them. That means they need to figure out what he can do now while they're still around. For the Eliases, the farmer's market is a start. The market is also a start for Jordan Howard, although his expectations are different. Jordan is hoping his experience managing the tent will help him get a job. He's also been practicing his interpersonal skills in mock job interviews. He's dressing the part.
Suit and tie, got a vest, I'm wearing suspenders instead of a belt, kind of a little fancy.
Jordan has had a lot of trouble with job interviews in the past. He's not good at judging how people react to him. He gets really nervous.
Well, I always think I'm being judged by other people just when I'm walking around, but this time I'm like, I know I'm being judged. So it's just that, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if I'm going to stand up to scrutiny.
He wasn't able to answer the questions in a manner that I felt would be appropriate for a job interview.
In other words, not up to scrutiny, says Carly Pereira. She's helping Jordan practice job interviews. Jordan wasn't able to name his strengths. He couldn't describe his personality. And he had trouble knowing what to tell about himself and what to leave out.
When somebody asks you, tell me about an average day or an average week, you don't say, I wake up, I go to the bathroom, I eat breakfast. And when people ask you what's an average day for you, they don't want to know about your Cheerios.
Carly's goal is to teach Jordan the art of summarization.
Hypothetically, he should be extremely, significantly more prepared today if he did what I asked him to do. So I guess we'll find out.
Jordan did much better in the second interview. At first, he had trouble elaborating. He stapled his resume on the right-hand side of the paper instead of the left. But as the interview progressed, he gained confidence. In the first interview, when asked about his ambitions, he said he'd like to be a manager with subordinates. This time he changed that to a manager with a responsibility. Also last time, when asked what irritates you about people, Jordan said dealing with people. This time he left that out. Still, at times it sounded like he was reading from a script. I counted all of the canned interview catchphrases: motivated, honest, team player. So I asked him,
"Do you believe everything that you said?"
For any potential employers out there, please tune out now. No, I really don't like working with people for the most part.
Why did you say that?
Well, because you say I don't like working with people, and they immediately think, oh, well, he's not a team player, you know, and this is a job where he needs to work with people, and it's a customer service job where he has coworkers. So you say I don't like people, you're thinking, okay, he's not going to get along with the customers or the coworkers. So, and I mean, and I can fake it, you know, I just kind of have to buckle down and do it.
Which is exactly what a lot of people do. Say what you need to say to get a job. For Jordan, that job and a paycheck is his path to independence. Jordan's friend Alex is taking a slightly different route. In April, he applied to the University of Washington. If he got in, he would have to move into his own apartment near campus. I asked him if he was ready to move out of his parents' house.
Yes. Oh, God, yes.
Alex is ready.
He's ready, but can he do it? We're about to find out. We're talking about coming of age with autism. Brian Bucklew has produced a series of reports. We're going to ask you to respond as well in about 10 minutes. What experience have you had working with people with autism? Yourself along the autism spectrum? How have you responded? How have you coped? How have you come up with the right way of working with other people? And given that more and more of these young adults who have been diagnosed with autism will be entering the workforce, what are you parents thinking about? What do you need from other people, from programs, from yourselves and your children? Our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us, weekday@kuow.org. You can take your calls in about 10 minutes, 206-543-5869. But first, let's jump to this summer with KUOW's Brian Bucklew and find out what Alex does when he finds out whether or not he's going to get into college.
Alex Brenner walked into his psychologist's office one day this summer. Right away, he thought he'd done something wrong. Both his parents were standing at the front desk. As he closed the door, his mom handed him a letter.
She said, "Read it." I sat down, and I opened it, and it said, "Congratulations, you're getting into the University of Washington."
That's why his parents were there.
I was actually stunned. It was probably the only word I'd describe right now. It was a big deal.
His dad helped him uncork a bottle of champagne, and they celebrated right there on the spot. The University of Washington in Seattle was Alex's first choice among schools. He'd been studying for 4 years at a community college to get his grades up. Finally, all of his hard work had paid off. But sitting there holding his acceptance letter, another wave of realization washed over him. Soon, he'd be living on his own in a new city, a long drive from his parents' home in Tacoma. He suddenly felt nervous.
Because I've always kind of relied on others, or at least have had an adult figure to kind of like talk to or just be a friend with. And I never had that with peers, because I'd always irk them or be a little creeped out because I was socially awkward. And pretty much they were the only ones I could talk to, so to have that kind of taken away, it's going to be a very new experience for me.
I'm cautiously optimistic, let's put it that way.
That's Valerie Brenner, Alex's mom.
It is time, because he's known for a long time that he will be living, you know, as an adult. But you always have concerns, and you have concerns with your typical children too.
Getting into the UW was a major accomplishment, but this new chapter in Alex's life is actually much bigger than just going off to college.
What I worry about is when we're not around anymore, because he has no siblings and we have no family, so to speak.
Alex's new apartment is actually a test. It's a test to see if he can manage living on his own. So the stakes are high move-in day. Everyone hopes it goes smoothly, but almost immediately things start to go sideways. Alex and his dad pull up in front of the building with all of Alex's belongings packed into a moving truck. But Valerie is already there, and she's not happy at all. Standing in the living room, she looks around and all she sees are problems.
So starting in the kitchen, the refrigerator is dirty underneath and on the outside. The countertops are dirty.
Valerie walks from the kitchen to the living room, pointing out what's wrong. She's visibly upset, and she's made a list.
The stove hood is greasy. The shelving paper needs to be replaced in the cabinets. Cabinets need to be cleaned and dusted.
When she shows her list to the rental agent, the agent says, basically, it's a college apartment. You can take it or leave it. Valerie and the agent get into an argument, and Alex gets uncomfortable and leaves. When he returns later, after the agent is gone, Valerie tells Alex, this is real life. You have to stand up for yourself, or people will walk all over you. Valerie gives the apartment a deep clean herself. Alex and his dad move his stuff into the smaller of two bedrooms. I ask him if he's having trouble fitting all of his stuff in.
For now, yes. I mean, you can just feel the tension in this room already when you walked in.
Yeah, I was going to say, so are you tired of moving?
Yes. I just want to lie down and, I don't know, sleep for a week.
And that's what Valerie worries about when Alex lives on his own, that he'll get overwhelmed by details or that he'll get bullied. Valerie always assumed Alex would move out, but she hasn't always been confident that he'd be able to manage once he did. So she developed ways to help him practice while he was still living at home.
The last couple of years, we've treated his bedroom as an apartment, so to speak. He's got his own refrigerator and microwave in there. He's got a mailbox outside the door so that when the mail comes, and he gets a lot of junk mail, he's able to go through that.
Now Valerie hopes those lessons apply to more than just sorting the mail.
You know, that's what we have tried to teach him is, you know, start here and there and there. Try not to let stuff get to a point where it piles up, because if it does, then you're not going to know where to start. He will shut down is what he does.
People with autism spectrum disorders have to figure out different ways to make their days work. Moving into a new apartment, Valerie says Alex may need some visual reminders to keep him on track.
I've actually known some on the spectrum that have a schedule from the minute they get up to the minute they go to bed at night.
It's actually broken way down into daily flow charts, like if I get up and take a shower, I'll have this much time. If I don't take a shower, I'll have time to do this or this or this.
We haven't had to do that with him yet, but, you know, I hope we don't have to, but we may have to. It just depends on what goes on with him. So,
Alex says he knows his mom feels scared by all of the sudden changes.
As far as my dad goes, I think he's more, I think he's more realistic. In which he's thinking, hey, you know what, you're going to be able to do this.
Yeah. What do you want to tell your parents?
I want to say that Alois is probably going to be really stressful to begin with. And, yeah, I'll screw up at times. I mean, I'm not a freaking robot or anything. I'm bound to make mistakes. But I'll pull through.
A month after Alex starts school, I stopped by to visit. He'd finished his only class for the day, physics. That's his toughest class. But he's found someone to tutor him. Most days he goes to school in the morning and then spends his afternoons and evenings studying. The University of Washington, he says, is much harder than the community college he got his associate's degree from. Plus, he has to advocate for himself now.
It's a totally new experience to me.
When Alex had trouble dealing with complicated situations in the past, he had his parents to lean on. If he needed to make an appointment with the teacher, he'd ask his parents to do it.
Now I'm kind of learning how to do it by myself.
It's a first for him, resolving his own problems and figuring out a routine. He says he likes making his own schedule.
You know, it's like you can mold it kind of like clay. You can mold it in any shape you want, any shape you please. You could just have a 5 o'clock breakfast or something. Or a pizza for breakfast. I had that once.
He never did that at home. Alex and his roommate have decorated how they like, and they've arranged the furniture in a way that works for them. I ask Alex if he ever gets homesick.
I miss certain parts of home, like my dog and spending a little bit of time with my parents. But I think I'm prepared to live on my own.
One of the first indicators will be his grades. They come out in a few weeks. Alex is a part-time student. He'll go full-time when he and his parents decide he's ready. He hopes to graduate in 3 years. If he does, he'll be the first among his autism support group to graduate from a four-year university.
KUOW's Brian Buckaloo prepared those reports. You'll get a chance to hear these stories again this week on KUOW. Funding for coming of age with autism was provided by the KUOW Program Venture Fund. Contributors include Paul and Lori Ahern, KUOW Board of Directors, and listeners just like you. To see photos of Alex, Jordan, Rolando, or to learn more about the Program Venture Fund, go to KUOW.org. You'll find graphs there about the increase in autism diagnosis in Washington State. We're going to take a break and then come back and get some of your reactions and your own experience about living with autism and your children or you coming of age with the disorder. That's coming up on Weekday.
Good morning. It's 9:45. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Hernia Center at Northwest Hospital, established to serve the entire region, featuring surgical specialists dedicated to treating patients with all types of hernia conditions. More information online at uwmedicine.org/hernia.
We have cloudy skies in Seattle, 51 degrees right now in the University District, working towards a high of 52 today. Forecast calls for clouds all day with a chance of showers. It's going to be cloudy tonight with showers, the low in the low 40s. Cloudy again tomorrow with a chance of showers, the high in the low 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering complete holiday meals, sustainably raised meats, seasonal recipes, and more, with 9 neighborhood locations. More information at pccnaturalmarkets.com/holiday. Support for KUOW comes from Levy Von Beck and Associates, for over 25 years helping property owners throughout Washington recover damages from defective construction, fire, and natural disasters. More information on the web at levy-law.com.
We heard 3 stories coming of age with autism. Brian Buckaloo produced them. They'll be on again later this week on KUOW. Health experts in the United States estimate 1 in 88 children has some type of autism spectrum disorder. In Washington State, the number of public school children with a diagnosis on the autism spectrum has increased by 430% in the last decade. And in the next decade, those teens with autism will become adults. So, what do you think about what you need to know, what you heard, and how you are coping with these disorder diagnoses? Sarah's in Kirkland. She has a 6-year-old son with autism. She joins us. Sarah, thanks for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
No problem.
What your 6-year-old son with autism, when you think about his coming years, what are your biggest concerns?
Oh, my goodness. It's so much. It can be overwhelming and paralyzing, and I'm grateful for programs like this that talk about what's coming up, because a lot of us parents are pioneers right now, kind of forging our own path, figuring out the future. And I'm grateful for those that have children that are older than us right now that are kind of, leaving information behind and helping us along. You know, Washington State's one of the few states that still does not mandate autism coverage for insurance. So a lot of us parents have to do therapies and advocating and find services for our children ourselves, which can be very overwhelming and very daunting. And it really makes these children even braver and stronger when they have to fight so hard to just have the same opportunities that neurotypical children have. And, you know, the one thing that I wanted to say or share that I think makes the biggest difference in our society is, you know, as people are beginning to talk about autism and more awareness is being raised, I keep hearing the word a lot, what's wrong with him, or if a child gets newly diagnosed, what's wrong with me. It's always in terms of right and wrong as opposed to what's different. And that's something that I've really learned as a parent, too, whereas when I would see a child or an adult and wonder, you know, what's wrong with them, why are they acting like that, I now think in terms of what's different and look for, you know, try and make the assumption first. Maybe there's a neuro difference there, instead of thinking that it's bad and it's wrong and it doesn't belong in society. And I really think that changing the way we think about that is what's going to make room for these children that are valuable and have things to offer to our society. And that difference, being different, isn't bad. And I just really think that paradigm switch will be really beneficial for us.
Sarah, I appreciate that. I appreciate those comments. And I like the phrase neurotypical. That's very useful. Thank you. Let me turn to Kelvin now. Hello, in Bellevue. Kelvin, you have a 12-year-old with autism. What are your fears looking going forward?
My fears are just growing up. You know, I live with him. I see him. I protect him. And that's what parents do. Parents protect their children. And I work for King County Metro, and I see adults get on my bus with mental illness, and I see the reaction of the general public. And right away, I think, what's going to happen when my son has to ride the bus? Will he get the same reaction that the general public gives the other people that get on my bus that have mental illness? But I don't consider my son having a mental illness. I consider my son just being different. And I consider him, you know, his brain works different. And I really don't know how to handle that other than just loving him for who he is.
But one thing it sounds like,
who does the same. And it's a thing that we've lived with for 12 years, but my wife has accepted it. And I'm learning to accept it because, as a father, you always dream of your son playing football, playing baseball. When you talk to other fathers and you hear them discuss what they're doing with their kids, you have to hold back the pain because your child may not be able to throw the football, kick the soccer ball, but you still love your son because he's your son and you're his best friend, and you may be his only friend, but what happens when you're no longer there to be his friend? That's what upsets me more, and it hurts. And I think a lot of fathers, they have a tougher time than the mothers because that's what fathers do. Fathers look to have that connection with their sons on that level. And I think that's what I have to learn, that my son is who he is. And it's something that society does not see. And as Sarah said, we have to look at them as being, you know, different, but still look at them as being part of our society. And I think that's what's so hard on me, and that's why I'm so protective. But that's the experience that I'm having, and my son is only 12.
All right, Kelvin, I heard that. I appreciate you talking to us. I appreciate that a lot. Thank you. Let me turn to Chris in Bellevue. Chris, you heard Kelvin. You heard how he was feeling. You have a son, a 12-year-old son with moderate autism. How do you see him in 10 years?
Well, yeah, my issue is I just kind of wanted to back up a little bit. My son's he's 12 years old. He's in the public school system, and it's really frustrating because they tend to just want to push them through regardless of testing and ability. Let's get him through. Let's get him graduated. And, you know, move on the next phase. It's, you know, I fight with the school almost daily. It's very frustrating. And our plan for him is to place him in community college and then hopefully a work program. But unfortunately, recently reality has hit me because I'm mentoring an adult girl with autism. She's worked really hard, got a paralegal certificate. She can't find a job. I mean, she has interviewed over 100 times easily, and she can't find a job. She's so discouraged. She so wants to be independent. So I've come to find that there really isn't a resource for, you know, young adults
with autism to help them be self-sufficient and get a job. And, she's willing to work for free. That's how terrible it is.
Is it the economy, or is it not that there's a lack of opportunity for somebody with this disorder?
Well, to be honest with you, I've even suggested, hey, can we get her to just do some filing and work, you know, under me? People, their perception of autism is really sad because, I mean, this girl is pretty amazing, but socially it's very awkward for people to talk with her, I mean, and to engage in conversation with her. And that reality hits home to me because I have this son at home that eventually will, you know, graduate with such a certificate, hopefully a college degree. I set high bars for him, and I know he struggles with it. But, you know, it's just there's something missing as a resource for these adults who are well-deserving to be independent.
All right, Chris, I appreciate that. Let me there's a couple other folks that have that same thought. Let's hear what they have to say as well. Let me go to Susan as well, who's in Bellingham. You have a 20-year-old son, Sue, is that right?
Yes, it is.
With profound autism. What kind of resources are available for him to be out in the world?
Not a lot. We have a wonderful program here in Bellingham in the afternoons for people with developmental disabilities, ages 14 and up. But he has to go with a caregiver because he can't toilet independently. There isn't a caregiver available for him to go to the program. I could go with him, but I would prefer that he go with someone else so that he can socialize. He needs to be with someone other than me. I'm a single mother. I wanted to bring up something that happened the other night in a local pizza parlor. My son is 6'2". And he has a beard, a small beard. And I think it's very apparent that there's something a little bit amiss with him. He makes odd noises. He walks on his toes. He's nonverbal. He's twiddling with his fingers. His head is cocked oftentimes a little bit. We went into the bathroom because he's unable to use the toilet independently. And we were at a local ice cream parlor. And I take him into the women's room with me and have been doing that for 20 years. When we came out of the restroom, there were two high school or college-aged women who said to me, "Oh, are you done in there?" And it never occurred to me that someone might think that there was something inappropriate going on.
Yeah, I get you. I get you. This is education for all of us, isn't it? Really, really, Susan, it's education for all of us, I think. All right, let me end with a comment about resources here, and I appreciate all your calls. Susan's in Tacoma. Susan, what's happening in Pierce County?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I got a minute for you.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sitting here with Sibylla, and her and I both have young adult sons with the autism spectrum disorder, and we started a support group called HUB here in Pierce County, and it's for young adults, 15 to 25-year-olds with high-functioning autism that kind of fall between the cracks, that really don't get a lot of services because they're high-functioning. And so our focus is going to be on education, employment, with a recreational component because of their social skills. They're lacking in a lot of social skills. So we're very excited about it. We meet once a month here in Tacoma. And here's Sibylla, too, to talk just a little bit briefly.
Just a couple facts. Hi, this is Sibylla. Just a couple facts that we kind of discovered that we found out that over the next 10 years, possibly 500,000 children with autism or intellectual or developmental disabilities will reach adulthood. And experts are saying that these issues need to be urgently addressed. It's kind of like a scary situation if we think about that, and we need to have all the support, all the components is in place to have them be, you know, independent individuals as much as they can, and we're here to do that. We are very excited about our new group. We just started about 3 months ago, so we're kind of like a little bit in the infant state, but it's coming. We are swamped. I mean, we are so excited. We really want to focus on supporting the family as a whole and really stress the two-wing program, which will be educational and employment.
All right, I got to leave it there. But did you find, real quick, did you find your group being replicated in King County or in other parts of the state?
There are a few other groups, but I think ours is somewhat unique.
Spell that again. What's it called?
Hub, H-U-B. Hub.
All right. We'll have people look for it, and I appreciate your call. Look for other aspects of autism at our KUOW.org website. This story will be on again, and we'll continue the conversation. We're going to talk with Thomas Ricks in a few moments about generals. Thank you very much. This is Weekday.
Headlines from NPR News are coming up next. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting Wagner's four-opera Ring Cycle in August 2013. Full cycle.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.